It is Friday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tensions along the Syria-Turkey border.
Whether it's the Syrian government forces, or whether it's the Kurds, or whether it's the Syrian rebels, or whether it's the Islamic State, having difficulty in maintaining control of their own territory.
Also ahead, African leaders praised for Ebola response, plus seeking a nuclear deal with Iran. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Islamic State fighters launched two major attacks in southern Syria on Thursday, a fresh offensive on the Kurdish-held border city of Kobani, and a push into government-held areas in the mostly Kurdish town of Hasaka. The attacks came after the militants suffered a series of setbacks in northern Syria against Kurdish forces in recent weeks. Here in Washington, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby was asked about the news of Islamic State gains.
Well, certainly it concerns us. I mean, any move by ISIL to take or to retake territory is of concern. I mean, we know that ground matters to this group. But I think we also need to have a little sense of perspective here. I mean, these reports of them attempting to retake Kobani are pretty fresh. Pretty new. They are not in control of Kobani, and Kobani remains well defended.
Meantime, Kurdish leaders in Turkey and Syria are accusing Ankara of allowing Islamic State forces to launch attacks into Syria from Turkish territory. Dorian Jones has our report from Istanbul.
The Islamic State's assault on the Syrian town of Kobani on Turkey's border is putting Ankara under political fire. A co-leader of Turkey's pro-Kurdish HDP, Figen Yüksekdağ, says there is a high probability that Ankara facilitated the attack, claiming it has for years supported the Islamic State. But Turkish officials strongly deny the accusation, saying such claims are lies and the latest attack originated from the IS-controlled town of Jarabulus. Ankara has been voicing growing concern about military gains against IS extremists by the Syrian Kurdish militia of the PYD, which controls Kobani. Retired Turkish ambassador Murat Bilhan, the vice chairman of the Turkish Asian Center for Strategic Studies, says Ankara's concerns center on the Syrian fighters' suspected links to Turkey's Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which has been fighting the government since 1984.
PYD is an extension of the PKK. That's the belief in Ankara. So Turkey has legitimate concerns about the PYD's expansion towards west, joining Kurdish belt on the whole south of Turkey, stretching from Iraq into Syria and probably aiming at reaching the Mediterranean.
Syrian Kurdish forces, fighting with elements of the rebel Syrian Free Army and backed by US-led airstrikes, have recently scored a series of major victories against the Islamic State. The Syrian Kurdish-led forces are just 50 kilometers from the jihadist headquarters in Raqqa. But earlier this month, Ankara slammed the PYD, accusing its forces of ethnic cleansing and warning it was watching events closely. International relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kardahas University says it's unlikely Turkey will directly intervene, but says the Turkish statement has added to Kurdish suspicion.
And from the government and from the media that is very close to the government come all these remarks that IS is less dangerous than the PKK or PYD, which they see as identical.
Despite Ankara's repeated denials it's facilitating or allowing jihadists to use its territory to enter Syria, it remains under growing pressure from its Western allies. Analysts say differences about Syria are straining U.S.-Turkish relations. Last month, U.S. President Barack Obama said Ankara needs to do more to secure its border, while Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan condemned Western airstrikes, claiming they are facilitating ethnic cleansing by Kurdish forces of Arabs and Turkmen. Diplomatic columnist Kadri Gusel of Turkey's Milliyet newspaper and Al Monitor website says Washington is likely to ignore Ankara's concerns, with Kurdish forces proving so effective against Islamic State. Bilhan says resolving the differences can only be achieved by rapprochement between Ankara and the PYD, But he warns that will take time.
Although the PYD has sent messages to Ankara through its chairman saying that, I mean, you don't have to fear from us. We are not against Turkey. But it doesn't still, I mean, serves any confidence in Turkey, because they can turn their weapons against Turkish interests anytime. So it will take some time for Turkey to test these people.
Turkey's political parties are trying to form a coalition government following this month's general election. A new government may offer the opportunity of expediting a rapprochement with the PYD. But analysts say key to those hopes will be the unfreezing of Ankara's peace process with the PKK. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
My colleague Susan Yaki caught up with reporter Jamie Detmer along the border between Syria and Turkey and asked him how the people in the region are feeling about the back and forth between the Islamic State militants and the Kurdish fighters.
Nervous and very confusing for people. What we're seeing in the last few months is all sides, whether it's the Syrian government forces or whether it's the Kurds or whether it's the Syrian rebels or whether it's the Islamic State, having difficulty in maintaining control of their own territories, and particularly of territory they've just captured. I think this is partly because all are suffering certain manpower shortages. They don't have enough troops to always retain the territory they've captured. So we get this seesawing that's going on in terms of the conflict, who's up and who's down. Only a couple of months ago, the Syrian rebels thought that they were on a good line after they managed to capture the city of Idlib, and were talking about driving down towards Homs and then upon Damascus. But they got diverted by Islamic State extremists who were very, very mobile in terms of their forces, who started to attack them further northeast towards areas that they control near the border, which completely diverted the attention, if you want, of these Syrian rebels around Idlib who had to go back northeast again. So we're seeing a very, very confused picture.
That is reporter Jamie Detmer. He is along the Syrian-Turkish border. Kurdish Twitter users are reacting angrily to Thursday's Islamic State assault on Kobani. VOA's Michael Lippin is here and is looking at what they're saying there on social media.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, many of those Kurdish Twitter users accused Turkey of complicity in the violence, saying Turkish authorities allowed the IS fighters to infiltrate Kobani from the Turkish side of the border. In fact, those Twitter users even accused Turkey of acting like a terrorist, going so far as to use the hashtag #TerroristTurkey, making it one of the top trending items on Twitter earlier in the day. Now, as you can imagine, Turkey rejects that label and that accusation. Its Deputy Prime Minister, Numan Kurtulmus, fired off a number of tweets trying to set the record straight. Kurtulmus said, "The claim that Daesh, another name for the IS group, passed through the Turkish border is entirely a lie and part of a black propaganda." The Turkish official also said that the perpetrators of today's attacks passed through the Syrian town of Jarabulus to get to Kobani, and he said that the Turkish government is on full alert to help the wounded and those in need of humanitarian aid. Now, the Turkish Deputy Prime Minister is actually a pretty popular guy on Twitter. His handle is @NumanKurtulmus, and he's got more than a million followers.
Man, how about the Kurdish rebels in Kobani and other parts of northern Syria? Are they on Twitter as well?
Yes, they are. And if you want to keep track of their tweets, here's one account that you can follow, that of Redur Shelil, and he is a spokesman for the YPG People's Protection Units, as they call themselves. His handle is @RojeKazad, and that's spelled RojeKazad. And he has got 32,000 followers, so he does have a following there. Regarding the allegations of Turkey letting IS fighters cross into Kobani, this is what Redur Shalil had to say on Twitter. "We do not confirm or deny that ISIS, another name for the militants, entered Kobani from Turkey." So perhaps that's a sign that the YPG doesn't want to upset the Turkish government too much. Steve?
Many thanks, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. You can stay on top of all the news at our website, voanews.com, and you can also join the conversation about the news, what's happening, on Twitter, our handle, @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. A senior U.S. administration official says Iran nuclear negotiators may not make that June 30th deadline for a final agreement. And Iran's spiritual leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has said that Iran would not allow international inspectors access to the military sites, scientists, or documents. University of San Francisco Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis told VOA's Victor Beatty, Ayatollah is the most powerful figure in Iran whose endorsement of an agreement will be required, and that his remarks are disturbing.
Even though Iran, of course, is an authoritarian system, it's not one-man rule. There are competing tendencies, both hardline and moderate. And while the Ayatollah Khamenei is the single most powerful, there are a lot of forces at work. And it appears that most Iranians, both in government and in the country as a whole, are in favor of moving the deal forward.
Stephen, on Wednesday, the Guardian Council ratified legislation that would ban access by international inspectors to military sites, scientists, and documents, making that binding law. Is that a problem?
These are only for non-nuclear sites. The rigorous inspection regime tentatively agreed to some months ago is not affected by this. At the same time, the agreement was somewhat vague in terms of exactly what ancillary sites would be included. So it is possible that this could be an obstacle, but not necessarily a fatal one.
How likely is a nuclear agreement on or about June 30th?
There are still a number of important outstanding issues to be resolved. The sequencing of sanctions relief with steps taken by the Iranians to cut their nuclear program, the extent of the inspections regime. But at the same time, the fact that Secretary of State Kerry is making the trip is indicative that there is some confidence in the White House as well as in European capitals that an agreement is in reach. There is the possibility, of course, of extending the deadline, but it's pretty clear that there will be a good faith effort to try to reach some kind of agreement by June 30th.
The Associated Press, quoting a confidential document, says Western powers, as part of this agreement, are offering Tehran high-tech nuclear reactors and fuel. How concerning is that?
Well, if you're an environmentalist, obviously any expansion of nuclear power anywhere, especially in a country prone to earthquakes, would be a matter of concern. But light nuclear reactors do not produce the kind of fuel that is capable of creating a nuclear weapon very easily. And if providing this kind of nuclear technology in exchange for halting construction on the heavy water reactor, which could potentially have military application, one could see this as an acceptable trade-off.
That is Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Palestinian Foreign Ministry has presented to the International Criminal Court in The Hague documents alleging that Israel and its military violated international law and committed war crimes during the 50-day Gaza war last year. Papers are not considered criminal evidence, but will be treated as part of the fact-gathering by the court's chief prosecutor to decide if there is strong enough evidence to open a criminal investigation. The move comes 3 days after United Nations investigators said both Israel and the Palestinian militant groups committed grave abuses of international human law, humanitarian law, that is, during the conflict that may amount to war crimes. More than 2,200 Palestinians, majority of them civilians, were killed in Israel's offensive against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And in Israel, 67 soldiers and 6 civilians were killed. Also in the news, a new report says critical decisions by African leaders helped turn the tide in West Africa's Ebola outbreak. The Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative, or AGI, says there is no substitute for political leadership. We get more now from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Writing in the AGI report, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says it's critical for people of the Ebola-affected countries to have a stake in their own futures. She says that governments should steer the course, but everyone must take a turn to row. Dan Heimowitz is head of the British Charities Insight and Learning Program and co-author of The State of Emergency, How Government Fought Ebola.
We worked in the 3 countries on the Ebola response. This is a report that's been developed based on our experience, our work, and what we saw. And what we saw is that while there's a perception out there that international actors, international organizations are primarily responsible for getting Ebola under control, what we saw is that it was Ghanaians, Sierra Leoneans, and Liberians who really stepped up to manage this crisis.
The report cites specific decisions made by the leaders of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. For example, Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma ordered the military to take the lead against Ebola because the Ministry of Health lacked resources.
I think that one was important, just recognizing that this wasn't purely a health challenge. A lot of the challenges of managing this crisis was getting the whole system to work. There was a lot of issues around logistics, just getting all the parts working together.
In Liberia, President Sirleaf went against culture and tradition by ordering the bodies of Ebola victims cremated and not buried. She acted on warnings from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization.
This was one of the most frightening and difficult moments in Ebola in Liberia. It was during those very frightening days where, you know, you had predictions of a future of 10,000 cases a day, maybe in January. That's what the CDC and WHO were predicting. And Liberia basically had run out of space to bury bodies in the county that includes Monrovia, the capital of Liberia.
Heimowitz says in Guinea, President Alpha Conde mobilized funds from a tight budget to buy protection equipment and ambulances and pay those who responded to the crisis.
In the early days of the response, before there had been the major international mobilization of resources, you had to find the resources. And again, I think that's another very good example of leadership from the top to get things moving.
The report says leaders are a symbol and must be seen to lead, adding that they can delegate work but not accountability. It recommends that systems and structures be put in place to allow the government to make the right decisions. It says there are 2 important lessons for effective response. Keep it simple, get it started and adapt it, and work out what information decision makers need. Heimowitz says credit must also be given to local heroes in the fight against Ebola. He gives the example of a woman he worked with in Monrovia.
Very late in the epidemic in Liberia, there was a situation where 30 gang members had been exposed to the disease, and it was a real risk that they might infect others in the city. And it was a young Liberian woman named Priscilla Dyla who was able to negotiate with the gang and convince them to self-quarantine and basically spend the next 21 days in isolation together.
The Tony Blair Africa Governance Initiative also has recommendations for international partners who are also described as heroes. It says that the response was most effective when international partners supported government's leadership, strategies, and plans, rather than pushing their own. Donors, it says, must be clear about what they can and cannot do, and be ready to adapt to ever-changing situations. AGI recommends using the lessons learned from Ebola to help Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone recover from the epidemic. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Here in the U.S., the body of South Carolina State Senator Clementa Pinckney came home Thursday evening to the church where he had been pastor for the past 5 years. That's Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. Pinckney was one of 9 African Americans killed by a white gunman during Bible study last week. President Obama will be delivering the eulogy at Pinckney's funeral later today. The suspected gunman, Dylan Roof, has been charged with the shootings. This is BOA.
This is BizBeat.
The sound of a high-pressure hose clearing away earth to recover gold at a mining site near Johannesburg. The area's been mined before, but thanks to a new technology, crews are able to extract more gold from previously abandoned mines.
Gold that was extracted from this crushed rock at surface, the processes weren't as effective as they are now.
Geologist Judith Kennard says even though the amount of gold recovered from the old mine dumps is less than what was originally found, there are no new deep mining costs, making it a viable operation. At a DRD Gold Ergo plant, Jaco Showman says gold is put into a solution with high concentrations of carbon.
Gold is loaded onto the carbon. The carbon is then removed and cleaned, and the gold stripped from the carbon prior to smelting in the smelt house.
This new technology helps to clean old gold dumps of potential environmental hazards, allowing the land to be redeveloped. For BOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. And now it's time for a little something from our music department. Here's David Byrd.
His first big radio hit was I Should Have Been a Cowboy, but now Toby Keith is a member of the Hall of Fame for songwriters. He went in there recently with some pretty big names, including Cyndi Lauper and Bobby Braddock. Here to talk about that and all things country music is VOA's Nikki Strong. Nikki, Toby Keith, he has been on the country music charts for almost 20 years now?
Yes, he's major. He's major. I think he has over 17 albums. He's quite prolific singer-songwriter. And he considers getting into the Songwriters Hall of Fame the pinnacle of his career.
Rather than performing in front of thousands of people in stadiums.
Exactly. This
is more important.
This was very important to him, to be acknowledged as a songwriter. He does say that. And he dedicates the honor to his grandmother, who gave him his first guitar.
Oh,
yeah,
well, isn't that
sweet.
Nice? Now, he also, I understand he was introduced by Stephen Colbert or something?
Yes, Stephen Colbert introduced him, and Stephen Colbert sang. And people were like, you know, he was like, okay. He knew Colbert was going to introduce him, but he didn't know Colbert was going to sing.
Right.
And Colbert did a decent job. A decent job.
A decent job.
Yes.
Okay. Well, now, also, I mentioned Bobby Braddock, and he is the songwriter who wrote one of Toby's hits. You said that he sang Toby's song, I Want to Talk About Me.
See, this is hilarious. Bobby Braddock, of course, another prolific songwriter who's written for tons of people, he performed at the ceremony, and he sang I Want to Talk About Me. Now, this was a song that he originally wrote for Blake Shelton.
Mm.
But Toby Keith wound up recording it and sending it to the top of the Billboard charts in 2001.
Now, speaking of songwriters and country music, Kelsey Ballerini is a young lady who is lighting up the country music chart with her new song, and it's Love Me Like You Mean It.
Yes, I love the song. When I first started doing country hits, that was the song that stuck with me.
Really?
Yep, it was 16, I think, on the charts at that time.
But it's number one on the airplay chart now.
Yes, the country airplay. And I'm like, go Kelsey. And she's an underdog, which is what makes it great. She's not on a big-time label. She's on an independent label. So
right.
This is quite an accomplishment.
And it's a very, very catchy. It comes out at a time of summer here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yes.
I can just picture, you know, kind of driving down the road with the windows open.
Yes.
Got this thing going. And it's, you know, it's also significant in that it is the first country single, I understand. First time an artist has had her debut single land at number one since Carrie Underwood did
it. Yes, first female.
Wow.
Yes, so this is perfect timing in light of the backlash, you know, when you had the major radio consultant that was saying women are tomatoes, they're garnishes, they're not the meat. And here comes Kelsey Ballerini, you know, topping the country airplay chart.
Which means more disc jockeys are playing this
song. Exactly. It means that people are liking the song as well, that people are listening and it's testing well.
All right. Well, if you have any questions or comments about either of these stories or anything you hear, you can hit Nikki up on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Also, you can listen to this segment again at VOA underscore IE for International Edition. You can check out Nikki's show, Country Hits USA, by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. Click on the Programs tab. You'll find it there. Nikki, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David.
That's Kelsey Ballerini. I'll have to hear more of that a bit later. I got another story for you here. A once homeless man from the U.S. state of Ohio, whose smooth radio voice made him an internet sensation, says he is running for president as an independent. Ted Williams was propelled to the spotlight a few years ago after he appeared in a video panhandling on a highway ramp with a sign advertising his golden voice. Well, the video got millions of hits. He had national television appearances. It was a big deal. He got a lot of voiceover jobs. He made some money. Well, Williams says he hasn't established a campaign staff and won't elaborate on any fundraising efforts. He says he plans to focus on several issues, including fair housing, veterans issues, jobs, and improving schools. Way to go, Ted Williams, huh? Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, hoping that you have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of the Middle East and Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on four key leaders of the terrorist group ISIL, or Daesh. With roots in a 1990s jihadi group, ISIL has dramatically undermined stability in Iraq, Syria, and the broader Middle East, posing a threat to international peace and security. It has recruited thousands from across the globe to fight in Iraq and Syria, committing gross, systematic human rights abuses, including mass executions, persecution of individuals and entire communities on their identity, killing and maiming children, rape, and other atrocities. ISIL claims to be the true heir of Osama bin Laden's terrorist legacy. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information on Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Qaduli, up to $5 million each for information on Abu Mohammed al-Adnani and Tarkan Teuma Razovich Batirishvili, and up to $3 million for information on Tariq bin al-Tahar bin al-Fali al-Ani al-Harzi. Al-Qaduli is a senior ISIL official who, when released from prison in 2012, traveled to Syria to join an ISIL network. As a member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI, he served as its leader Abu Masab al-Zakari's deputy and as its emir in Mosul, Iraq. Al-Adnani, whose birth name is Taha Sobi Falaha, is a senior ISIL leader and its official spokesman, the main conduit for disseminating ISIL messages. He has repeatedly called for attacks against Westerners and has vowed defeat for the United States. Batirishvili has served as a senior ISIL commander and Shura Council member. He has overseen an ISIL prison facility in Al-Tabqa, where ISIL possibly held foreign hostages, has worked closely with ISIL's financial section, and has managed ISIL operations in the Manbij area of Syria. Al-Harzi was one of the first terrorists to join ISIL and has served as an ISIL official operating in Syria. He has helped to raise funds from Gulf-based donors and was recruited and facilitated the travel of ISIL fighters. He was named as leader for the border region between Syria and Turkey. He also has served as chief of ISIL's suicide bombers. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have such information, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.